Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Good evening, and thank you for coming out on such a horrible night to hear Molly Peacock read for us tonight. I'd like to tell you about the upcoming Poetry Center event before I get started introducing Molly. The next event will be a reading by three poets, all published by Copper Canyon Press: Sam Hamill, James Galvin, and Eleanor Wilner. This reading is part of a program that highlights presses that publish poetry, and it will take place right here in the ballroom on Wednesday, January 14th at 6 p.m., so I hope to see you all there. When Molly Peacock writes a poem about something as provocative as an alcoholic father bullying his young daughters, I doubt that many of her readers lay their books down and say, "I wonder whether this poem is autobiographical." Because however dramatic or raw her material may be, Peacock transforms it into poetry so well-crafted that her reader marvels not at the teller, but at the telling. When I first read her work in the early 1980s, I was amazed to discover someone of my own generation writing formal poetry. I found in her a poet as playful in her rhymes as any Renaissance poet, as adventurous in her off-rhymes as Emily Dickinson, but still a poet speaking in the language of my own time. She can revel in the sensuality of words and the complexity of an extended metaphor and still sound like she means what she's saying. These qualities distinguish her among the new formalist poets. While much of contemporary formal poetry tends toward a regular, somewhat Augustan, iambic pentameter, Peacock's meters are various and supple, or as she said on the way over here, she said, I don't write in meter, which I don't think is entirely true, but sometimes it's very loose. And nobody rhymes like she does. Her subjects are wide-ranging. In one poem, a young girl is sent into a bar to search for her father. In another, a woman explores the complexity of her decision not to bear a child. And in another, the speaker meditates on the minute struggle of a fallen leaf to turn itself over on the ground. Molly Peacock is the author of four books of poetry, including Live Apart, Raw Heaven, Take Heart, and most recently, Original Love. She has just completed a memoir, Paradise Piece by Piece, which will be the lead nonfiction title next May from Riverhead Books, a division of Penguin Putnam. And she's going to be reading a little bit from that memoir tonight, right? Her work has been honored by fellowships from the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the NEA. She is past president of the Poetry Society of America, and she is now president of their board. She lives part of the year in Ontario, Canada, and part in New York City, where she advises the Transit Authority's Poetry in Motion program, and she teaches private poetry tutorials there. She will be taking questions after her reading, and she will be signing books after the reading as well. So welcome, Molly Peacock.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank the sponsors of this reading and also to say how marvelous it is to be reading in such a gorgeous place that I did not know what this place was going to look like, but somehow I intuitively dressed for it. This is a distinguished reading series, and I'm very, very glad to be one of the drops in the ocean of literature that flows through this room under these auspices. I'm going to start off with somebody else's poem because the Poetry Society of America has cooperated with the Transit Authority here in Chicago to bring Poetry in Motion to Chicago. And this is an extremely, extremely exciting thing for me to see poetry on public transportation, and I'm going to just doff my hat to the public transportation in Chicago and read this tiny little poem. It's a fragment from a poem by Muriel Rukeyser called "Yes," and it, in a way, sets up some of the themes that I'm going to be talking about in the reading. This is from "Yes." Some go local, Some go express. Some can't wait to answer yes. Some complain of strain and stress. Their answer may be no for yes. Some like failure. Some like success. Some like yes, 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 yes. Open your eyes, dream, but don't guess. Your biggest surprise comes after yes. I hope I surprise you. I'm going to open, with a poem from Original Love, my last book, and I'm making that a kind of prologue poem. It's a prologue poem in the book, and it's a prologue poem in a way, and another prologue in this reading, because then I'm going to intersperse some small pieces from my memoir, Paradise, Piece by Piece. But first, this poem called Why I Am Not a Buddhist. It will be quickly apparent why I feel this way. Why I am not a Buddhist. I love desire. The state of want and thought of how to get. Building a kingdom in a soul requires desire. I love the things I've sought. You in your beltless bathrobe. Tongues of cash that loll from my billfold. And love what I want. Clothes. Houses. Redemption. Can a new mauve suit equal God? Oh no. Desire is ranked. To lose a loved pen is not like losing faith. Acute desire for nut gâteau is driven out by death. But the cake on its plate has meaning. Even when love is endangered, and nothing matters. For my mother, health. For my sister, bereft, wholeness. But why is desire suffering? Because want leaves a world in tatters? How else but in tatters should a world be? A columned porch set high above a lake. Here, take my money. A loved face in agony. The spirit gone. Here, use my rags of love. Paradise Piece by Piece is a book about all of the choices that I've made in my life. And now let's see. This is a question, of course, I should have asked a bit ago, but can everyone hear me? Because I'm as I get closer to the microphone, I know that you can hear the puzz in the... so I'm backing away a little bit. And there are a lot of puzz in Paradise Piece by Piece. This book, the kinds of choices that I'm talking about are choices that affect just, many people in this room, because my guess is that there are lots of writers in this room. So it's about my choice to be a poet. And there's a larger choice that in fact affects everyone, and it's also about my choice not to have children. It's in four parts, and the first part is called A Girl's Garden of Reasons. When I was three, I decided not to have children. Pressed to the linoleum floor with a coloring book, I spied on my two-year-old sister from under the kitchen table. As she skidded noisily by on her new wooden wheel toy, my father came in from his job with the electric company. Out scraped his chair from the table. In scraped his chair with him on it. When his beer bottle thudded above my head, I swiped my crayons back from his work boots and uniformed pant legs. From deep under the table roof, I peered at my mother Polly's loafers moving back and forth at the stove. She was not wearing socks, even though it was winter, and this was Buffalo, and that kitchen floor was cold. Blue snow light outside, heat haze in the kitchen, then the spatter of floured chicken pieces as they hit the oily stomach of an iron skillet. Graham's head of tight gray curls lingered in the doorway of our living room. Everybody was tired or angry. The squeal of the wooden wheels of my sister's ride-on toy distressed even me. "Can't you make her stop? I just got home," my father cried out. "For Christ's sake, she's only two," my mother said, not bothering to turn her plaid flannel back from the sizzling stove. If I looked up aslant, I could see her almost fully, black curls above a man's work shirt and old wool slacks. The light got yellower and the spattering louder, almost as loud as the wheels that ground against the linoleum and the bang of the empty beer bottle on the table. "Don't ever have children, Molly," my grandmother declared, "unless you want to." "That's right. Don't let nobody say you have to have kids," her son affirmed. I often heard from my father, "Don't ever have children, Molly." My grandmother punctuated this with, "unless you want to." And my mother said, "You can always do anything you want." I'm not sure other families discussed having children with their children as frequently as mine did. But I heard again and again in various ways from these three people that having children wrecked everything. Or this was how I interpreted them. I looked at my little sister as she zoomed across the linoleum and hated her even more. I looked at my father drunk and my mother frightened and thought, their lives would be better if they didn't have kids, if they didn't have her, didn't have us, me, if I were gone. I'm not having any children. Somehow, at five, I was past childbearing age. Because I felt that perhaps I shouldn't have been born, there were many parts of me that waited decades to arrive. Even in a passing conversation about a garden, the phrase, "dead in the bud," can stop me for a second with a metaphorical chill. There were many ways I struggled not to be dead in the bud. I knew quite early I was engaged in a test. Later on, people would call it survival. But I felt I would be alone in it, as alone as each person in my family was. Now, so many years later, at my dining room table eating a piece of gingerbread from Emily Dickinson's recipe, a woman who recommended that we look at life aslant, I have an additional interpretation of my father's exhausted, frustrated statement against having children. It gave me a choice. As it turns out, my choice not to have children has defined my adult life. It's been like hacking through undergrowth at the same time as I've been walking down a hardly used, perfectly paved way. In fact, on that path, my choice not to be a mother became more of a discovery of a decision. I had to make the choice from so far down in my own core that I was never wholly aware of it. It took insight to see and release it, an insight I didn't always have. For this is a decision you do not make once, but many times. I'm going to go back and bring those two girls into their teenage years and bring that father further on into his life and read a poem from Take Heart that Deborah very nicely, kindly referred to in the introduction. This poem is called Say You Love Me. And I read it for anyone in this room who has ever had anyone extort an emotional statement from them. That's probably all of us. It is, for those of you who are interested in these things, it's in a very idiosyncratic terza rima. I'm writing about a domestic hell and picked the Dante's rhyme scheme from the Inferno, appropriated it to my own purposes. What happened earlier, I'm not sure of. Of course he was drunk, but often he was. His face looked like a ham on a hook above me. I was pinned to the chair because he'd hunkered over me with arms like jaws pried open by the chair arms. "Do you love me?" he began to sob. "Say you love me." I held out. I was probably 15. What had happened? Had my mother, had she said or done something? Or had he just been drinking too long after work? "He'll get mean," my sister hissed. "Just tell him." I brought my knee up to kick him, but was too scared. Nothing could have got the words out of me then. Rage shut me up, yet, "Do you?" was beginning to peel, as of live layers of skin, age from age, from age from him, until he gazed through hysteria as a wet baby thing repeating, "Do you love me? Say you do," in baby chokes, only loud, for they came from a man. There wouldn't be a rescue from my mother, still at work. The same choking sob said, "Love me, love me." And my game was breaking down because I couldn't do anything, not escape into my own refusal. "I won't. I won't." Not fantasize a kind, rich father. Not fill the narrowed zone, empty except for confusion, until the size of my fear ballooned as I saw his eyes blurred, taurian. My sister screamed. Unknown to me, a voice rose and leveled off. "I love you," I said. "Say I love you, Dad." "I love you, Dad," I whispered, leveled by defeat into a cardboard image. untrue, unbending. I was surprised I could move, as I did to get up. But he stayed, burled onto the chair. My monstrous fear, she screamed again, my sister, "Dad, the phone, go answer it." The phone wasn't ringing, yet he seemed to move toward it, and I ran. He had a fit. "It's not ringing." But I was at the edge of it as he collapsed into the chair and blamed both of us at a distance. No. The phone was not ringing. There was no world out there. So there we remained, completely alone. Now, I had one of those lives that got better and better, and so that it is possible to look for me to look back on bad moments and be in the grip of them, but also understand them from a kind of perspective of much greater security in every possible way. However, that took a long time to come by. And in part two of my memoir, part two is called The Poetry Womb. And part of it happens in the poetry room of the college that I went to. But this sister grows up, and I grow up, and now I'm a sophomore in college, my parents have divorced, and my dad's in pretty bad shape. So this is just another little section. D'Agostino's is a New York supermarket. I think that's all you need to know. And the Upper East Side is a fancy neighborhood of New York. And the Fillmore East was a rock club. In 1966, chicken legs were 69 cents a pound in the D'Agostino's on 2nd Avenue and 74th Street. I wore my specially knotted scarf around my homemade mini dress. Nestled in my underpants was the string from a Tampax. I pushed my cart among the blondes in beige linen with pearls and sandals, throwing filet mignons and salad greens into their carts. A girl, also blonde, but a shaggier, dirtier blonde, came up the aisle toward me. She was barefooted. She wore a black spangled flapper dress and ropes of jet beads and carried a khaki duffel bag. "Hey, Mo," she burbled. "It's me. I ran away." My sister Gail had borrowed bus money to come to New York. She had gotten a job at the candy counter at the Fillmore East, just a block from where I picked up the two boys I babysat. I was an au pair girl for the summer. Into the mild murmur of the Upper East Side supermarket, she spoke in a loud, gravelly voice, even louder when she said, "And believe me, at the candy counter, we don't just sell M&Ms. It's the best candy counter in the village." She winked one bright eye, just like a macaw. Ran away? On borrowed bus money? Here? I ushered her out of the D'Agostino's, where our doorman had told her to find me, not daring to look around me at the checkout counter, the burn of embarrassment increasing as I approached our doorman again, of whom I was very frightened. I was sure I would be tossed out of the apartment I had no real right to live in anyway, bringing up a barefooted girl in an antique dress to the 19th floor. We entered the sparsely furnished Ellisman place with its odd blend of gold-rimmed china but crummy stainless steel cutlery and Egyptian cotton deep blue towels but ratty bedspreads. Hey, you live here? Cool. But it's too far uptown. I like it downtown, Mal, Gail said. I was quiet. I more than anything did not want her to ask to crash in the apartment I barely had a claim to. Hey, Mal, she continued. Graham could have worn this dress. Isn't it cool? She did look cool. I can't stay long, she said. I've got to be at Max's Kansas City. All these great people are there, Viva and everybody. Want to come? I left Buffalo Girl. Leslie Fiedler helped me, and now I'm at the Fillmore. But Mom said you left 2 months ago. Had it taken her 2 months to hitchhike from Buffalo to New York? Girl, it was an ape fuck. No kidding. I went to California, Malsy. Hey, I'm never wearing shoes again. I'm going to let big, huge calluses grow on my feet, and I won't feel anything through them. People weren't meant to wear shoes. Are you sure you don't want to come to Max's? It's really cool there. We can sit with Viva. I looked down at my homemade electric purple and orange dress. It really was a kind of nerdy psychedelic dress. I'm really tired, I said. I just got my period. I thought I was pregnant. I began to confess. Me too, she crowed. Only I had to pay to get out of mine. I had to pay high, Malsy. She stopped. Hey, you got any tea or coffee or like caffeine thing? She followed me out to the kitchen where I put the teapot on to boil. I called Mom from San Francisco, and I asked her for $500, and you know what the bitch said? She was calling Polly a bitch. Calling our mother a bitch. She told me no, she wouldn't help me. How alone Gail must have felt out there. How alone Polly must have felt going to her new job at 6:30 a.m. and looking for an apartment at night after her divorce. When she had the apartment, she hoped Gail would come home. Would I tell her where Gail was? So what did you do? I asked. My eyes must have been round as coat buttons. Gail had had to have an abortion, and I had not. She asked our mother for the money. Why not the boy? Bill and Dan paid for it. Two of them? That's the end of that section. I've got a lot of pieces of paper here. You know, for years, I'm no longer president of the Poetry Society of America, but for years I was, and I used to go to a lot of poetry readings. And when I noticed the speakers start to shuffle papers at a podium, I always got really nervous. But I still am in order. This is a poem that uses... something that we see often in prose as a subject, but not something that we see a lot of in poetry, although I have enjoyed very much putting it into my poems. I told a workshop last night that there really are only two subjects for poetry. One was love, and the other was loss. And I distinguished that from the three subjects of prose, of fiction at any rate, love, loss, and money, financial considerations do creep into the next poem, which is about a great activity, shopping. And this also is in those strange three-line stanzas that for those of you who are interested in this kind of thing, are fun to rhyme because unless you're rhyming all three of them at the same, as Elizabeth Bishop did in Pink Dog, if you know that poem, then one of those words at the ends of the line is not going to be rhymed, and you've got to do something else with it. And you might hear some of those something else's as we go down. This is a narrative poem called How I Had to Act. And it sounds like it's not at all PC. The person repents in the end. How I Had to Act. One day, I went and bought a fake fur coat from two old ladies in a discount shop no young woman should have walked into. Taupe fluff with leopard spots for $400, which I charged, no cash till my paycheck. Admired by the two sales lady crooks. 5 minutes later, I was at my shrink's, casually shoving the bag by a chair, one arm flopping out synthetically. Trinkets, all belonging to my crooked grandmother, floated across the wall, already filled with the shrink's trinkets. Afterwards, among the minks on the street, I caught sight of my grandmother in a shop window. The wind was howling. I wore the fake coat with a babushka. Another possibility was that was me. I didn't have $400. And felt humiliated by what I had acted out and berated myself for buying a blazer in the size of my sister the week before. You mess. I called myself a lot of names. Eyes on the bus looked up when I barreled on in the coat I couldn't return to the store. I refused to go shopping alone anymore. My rich friend said, a fun fur. How daring. How daring to become my clever, lying grandmother. And before that, my sister, whose loved but dirty, stuffed leopard Graham had craftily destroyed. I had promised myself a real fur coat. A real fur coat, which I wanted as I did a real self, employed with real feelings. Instead, I bought a fake, which I couldn't afford. What a mistake! I chortled to my shrink, who agreed, though I did not want her to. How terrible, I wanted her to say. How terrible you have to act this way. Now in New York on the subway, we have MetroCard. And soon tokens will be artifacts. This next poem is called The Fair, and I'm going back and forth between my two last books of poems. And The Fair is in Original Love. And by Original Love, I meant all the kinds of primary love. The most obvious primary love is mother love. And this poem called The Fair, F-A-R-E, appears in the end a kind of, well, a transaction for train fare. And all of that stuff about death and about Chiron taking you across the River Styx and having to go underground to that river and all that stuff, that's all in the background there in that subway token, which never does appear until the very end of the poem. I have worked a lot. I said this to people last night. I worked a lot with writers on a one-to-one basis. And I have become humbled by my studies of individuals' creative processes. I used to make a lot of generalizations from my own creative process, thinking everyone did it that way. And it's not true. And usually I make a poem by, I have a little bit of a game plan in mind. This poem, I have to say, came out in such a rush of feeling that I couldn't have a game plan. It almost formed in reverse. I had to make the plan afterwards. So that's a little something about the form of it. And the other thing is, I see that there are some people in this audience who need to know another fact. And that is, for those of you who've never worn clip-on earrings, I need to tell you that the experience of wearing a clip-on earring is extremely painful. Even when they give you those little rubber hands to put on them, etc., when you see people wearing clip-on earrings, grab them from their ears and throw them across tables, beds, floors. You have to understand that they've been in pain for hours. That really is relevant. All those things are relevant to the following poem, The Fair. Bury me in my pink pantsuit, my mother said. And I did. But I never dressed you before. I saw the glint of gold in your jewelry drawer and popped the earrings in a plastic bag along with pearls, a pink and gold pin, and your perfume. What's this? The mortician said. Oh, well, we'll spray some on. Now your words from the coffin. Take my earrings off. I've had them on all day, for God's sake. You've had them on 5 days. The lids closed, and the sharp stab of a femininity you couldn't stand for more than 2 hours in life is eternal. You'll never relax. I'm 400 miles away. Should I call up the funeral home and have them removed? You're not buried yet. Stored till the ground thaws. Where? I didn't ask. Probably the mortician's garage. I should have buried you in slippers and a bathrobe. Instead, I gave them your shoes. Oh, please, do it for me. I can't stand the thought of you pained by vanity forever. Reach your cold hand up to your ear and pull. And hear the click of the clasp hinge unclasping. Then reach across your face and get the other one. And this effort could take you days. I know you're dead. But let it be your last effort to change my mistake and be dead in comfort. Lower your hands in their places on your low mound of stomach and rest. Rest. You can let go of the earrings. They'll fall to the bottom of the casket like tokens. Return fair, fallen to the pit of a coat's satin pocket. In part three of the memoir is called Pruning the Family Tree. where I fall in love with a glamorous European performance artist, and I come to understand what it means to live life creatively. I'm not going to read you from that part. I'm going to go on after I've learned my lessons of living life creatively. I'm going to read you a tiny piece from the very end of the memoir, and that introduces the last couple of set of poems that I'm going to read. Simple companionship. My parents rarely had it, though both sets of my grandparents seemed to. It occurred to me, not for the first time, that I skipped the married with children part of my life and proceeded right into the atmosphere of grandparenthood, the companionship two people feel after their kids have left home. But for my husband Mike and me, it's after we've separated from our youthful miseries. Nothing holds us but a we have constructed. The sense of completeness I have, the wholeness and fulfillment, did not come from insisting that the world fill my internal prescription. It came because all I had to do was ask. I asked myself continually who I was, and eventually I knew what I needed. My old life, like deadheads on rangy petunias, fell completely away. If I could have told that girl who waited to hear her father's car crawl up the driveway that things would never be as bad as at that moment, I think she would not have believed me. But I imagine whispering into her ear, a skinny little shrimp with lank hair wearing a soiled blouse, her face at once both horrified and grim, that her life will be an adventure, and that she will become a poet and live in two countries with a boy she would meet very soon. I see her turn her head a little bit on her neck, straightening her slump just a bit, and watch a slow, non-committal sort of astonishment begin in her spine, delight moving up her vertebrae until it hits the top of her head and moves her shoulders back. I tell her she's 14 years old, that if she holds on for 30 years, she's going to love her life. This girl does not say, 30 years? How will I hold on? She is silent. She does not dare complain or hope. Instead, she walks. She walks across an empty plain, requiring that emptiness completely. Paradoxically, for her, it will become full of creativity. When I said no to having children, I felt as if I went to some viscerally interior place, the place of recognition. I'd always thought that the positive, the embracing, the yes that is so characteristic of women's assumed responses would let me affirm who I am. but it was a refusal that led me to understand my own nature. It was the saving no. The saving no seemed to emerge from the ready emptiness that is required for all creativity, not just for the making of art. That no can't be confused with loss or the painful emptiness of not having what you need. It's a room, not a womb. Like a womb, it harbors life, but unlike a womb, it leaves room to create the rest of life. And these are a couple of poems from The Rest of Life. They're from Original Love. And one of the great pleasures of being a woman writing in the late 20th century is that all subjects are open to us. And so the subject of a woman's sexuality becomes very available. Of course, it doesn't always go perfectly, as we all know, those experiences in bed. And so I wrote this poem in response to a friend's dare. It's to answer a question. It is what I have to call an overgrown sonnet. I do aim for them, but they're not always controllable. The question, which is the title, is: have you ever faked an orgasm? When you get nervous, it's so hard not to. When you're expected to come in something other than your ordinary way, to take pleasure in a new way, lost, not knowing how to drive it back to sureness, where are the thousand, thousand flowers you always pass? The violet flannel, then the sharpness. You can't extinguish the star in a burst. It goes on glowing, one's head between the other's legs so long. Do they really want to be there? One whimpers as though, then gets mad. One could smash the other's valiant head. You didn't come, did you? Naturally, you know, although I try to lie, the truth escapes me, almost like an orgasm itself. Then the no that should crack a world, but doesn't, slips free. There are, I think we can all safely admit this in this room, there are sexual experiences in which you have thoughts. You think during this act. I have written on the gamble, I've written everything I've written on the gamble that other people, there must be somebody else out there who's having the same experience I am. And this is about that thinking and that that union of so many things that occurs as two people find their way together. So this is called The Return. And it's a different kind of poem. It's a poem that sort of builds metaphor on metaphor about returning in all kinds of ways. When she opens her legs to let him seek inside her, seeking more, she thinks, what is he looking for? And feels it will be hid from her whatever it is, still or rapidly moving beyond her frequency. Then she declares him a mystery and stops herself from moving and holds still until he can find his orgasm. Peak is partly what he looks for, and the brink he loves to come to and return to must be part of it too. Thrust, build the trust that brings her surprised to a brink of her own. She must be blind to something of her own he recognizes and looks for. A diamond speaks in a way through its beams, though it's dumb to the brilliance it reflects. A gem at the back of the cave must tell you, yes, you can go back. And the last poem I'll read for all of you, it's called Little Miracle. And it's for everyone who gets to a room at 6 o'clock in crummy weather. We've all had to make some special arrangements in order to arrive here. And this is a villanelle, and it has a word in it that I actually learned shortly before I wrote the poem, so I'm gambling that a few people in here might not know what it is either. The word is coracle, and a coracle is a wicker fishing boat. That's all you need to know. It's for all of us Philofax keepers. Little Miracle. No use getting hysterical. The important part is we're here. Our lives are a little miracle. My hummingbird-hearted schedule beats its shiny frenzy day into year. No use getting hysterical. It's always like that. The oracle a human voice could be is shrunk by fear. Our lives are a little miracle. We must remind ourselves. Whimsical and lyrical, large and slow and clear, so no use getting hysterical. All words other than I love you are clerical, dispensable, and replaceable, my dear. Our inner lives are a miracle. They beat their essence in the coracle our ribs provide. The watertight boat we steer through others' acid, hysterical demands. But ours is the miracle. We're here. Thank you very much.